welcome to Wednesday's edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We hope your day is going well. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In the second half of today's show, we're stirring the pot. And of course, I'm talking about Prairie Plates with host Rick Guillon and two flavorful guests today, Michael Miller and Jeremy Kopp from the Germans from Russia Heritage Collection at North Dakota State University. They'll serve up a rich conversation on how heritage lives on through food. Think Nephila soup, cheese buttons, and Kugan, with tasty stops from Wishick to West Fargo. Plus a sneak peek at a Lawrence Welk documentary hitting Bismarck later this month. As we begin Main Street on this Wednesday, it's time for our Philosophical Currents monthly discussion with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota and host of Why? Philosophical discussions about everyday life. Jack, how are you?
Oh, I'm happy to be here. The recent rainstorm made all of the grass green and my mood is in a much better place than it's been for a while.
So it brought back life, so to speak?
Yes, very nice. Very nice, Craig.
So today we are going to pull a question right from the headlines or maybe even from the Ice Age. I'm not sure. Should we bring back extinct species? Should we bring them back to life, from woolly mammoths to the dire wolves that, and I'm using that dire wolves in air quotes, that we've now seen? De-extinction raises fascinating ethical questions about science, nature, and our role in shaping the future. And even if Jack and I don't know a lot about the science behind all of this, there are those who are trying to do it. Question is, should we? And we'll dive into that. Jack, from a philosophical standpoint, what moral obligations, if any, do we have to species that have become extinct, and even species that humans help drive to extinction?
You know, this is a super interesting question, and there's a whole lot of threads that we can pull. We have to have a larger vision of what our responsibility is to the ecosystem as a whole, and what our responsibility is to the people and the future and all of that sort of thing. At the heart of this is a vision of our relationship between us and nature, and this is actually one of the places where people really disagree. Are we caretakers of nature? Is it our responsibility to care for it because it is in some sense helpless or has no agency? Or is nature just a collection of resources for us to exploit? The Abrahamic tradition, the Bible, suggests at some point the second, right after the fall, when Adam and Eve leave the Garden of Eden, God says to them, you know, this is all of yours to build off of and to use as your tools, but it will be through pain and labor and all of that sort of stuff. And that attitude led to mass destruction of wooded areas, horrible contamination of water, real sense that all we need is to use these things for our own benefit. And then other people came along and said, this is a path to destruction. It's a path of destruction for the whole world. It's a path of destruction for human beings. And they started looking not only at different philosophies of nature, but also different cultures and the way that they've dealt with nature and what it means to live alongside. So at the very heart, at the very first, at the beginning of the question, is a fundamental point of view that is going to help send us down the ethical path.
It seems to me now there's little, if any, regulation about what is happening, that a company is moving forward. We've seen pictures of what they say is a dire wolf. Who knows if it is or really isn't? Yet they're marching forward on their own, it seems, to do it. Is that an ethical thing to do?
This is also a huge fault line in the discussion, because law is inherently conservative. What law does is establish our reality based on the past. And I'll give you an example. 100, 150 years ago, a bunch of people in Grand Forks or Fargo or Bismarck decided this is how big a housing lot is going to be, right? This width, this length, this is what it means. This is how much of land you have to have for one house or two houses or what have you. That binds the decisions that I make. That tells me where I can purchase houses, how big of a lot it can be. So in a certain way, people 100, 150 years ago control my life. Science, however, happens really fast. And anytime there's a new discovery or a new chemical or anything like that, law often doesn't address the issue. This is one of the fundamental complexities with drug regulation, right? Someone comes up with a new synthetic drug, LSD-7 or something like that. It's not illegal yet, and people can use it until the legislation catches up. This is one of the issues we're having with the internet right now. There's a lot of stuff going on that the government, our older government officials, don't understand. Ethics doesn't have the same limitations because it's not necessarily a matter of legislation, it's not necessarily a matter of consent, but it is still slow in that it builds off of the past. So the question that we ask ourselves is, how is the new situation similar or analogous to how we've seen, to what we've seen so far? What can we extrapolate from the past that we can apply to the future? And so the first question ethicists are going to ask is, does this harm? Does this hurt people? Is this a force of good or a force of bad? And once we have a sense of that, then we can start asking subordinate questions that help us negotiate the details. We always have to ask, what have we learned from the past that we can work by analogy to our present situation?
You've brought forward a question in our discussions prior to our conversation right now. Should resources be exploited or utilized to bring back a woolly mammoth or that species that is almost extinct today, but we can work to save now? Have you thought more about that?
Well, so I want to take a step back, because when you posed this as the topic of conversation, I responded, I don't really know that much about it. And so what I wanted to do was spend a little time and talk about how philosophers approach a new topic. And the very first thing I did was contact my friend, because we have to figure out what the facts of the situation. We have to have a sense of the context, and we have to have a genuine sense of understanding. So I reached out to my best friend, Gail Sherman, who's a writer for Boing Boing, which is a major longstanding blog. And she's got the science and technology and cute animals beat. And we talked about the dire wolves and her position, and then I looked into it and agree with it, is that these are not dire wolves. That
what do you mean by that? Because we're being told they are.
Yes, it's spin, it's marketing, it's not what it claims to be. Colossal Laboratories came out and said they've resurrected dire wolves from extinction, and they, you know, probably want to put it out in the wild. And that's not at all what happened. What they did was they took a gray wolf, an actual real-life gray wolf, took their DNA, put it in CRISPR, the machine that allows for DNA manipulation, and reproduced a copy of the direwolf DNA. Then they took this modified gray wolf DNA and they put it in a dog, and the dog gave birth. And what you have now is sort of a dog-wolf hybrid that looks like a direwolf, but actually isn't a direwolf. And so there are two questions. The first is, if you reproduce something using DNA, is the copy the same thing as what it originally was? And we're actually really familiar with this because we ask this philosophical question when we watch things like Star Trek. Anytime you have teleportation, right, the way the science fiction mechanism uses works is you go in the teleporter, the computer interprets your code, it sends that code to another teleporter 1,000 miles away, and it reproduces the code and gives you a new body. Is that the same person? In the stories, you have the same consciousness, you have the same memories, but is the material the same material? There's actually a really interesting, long-standing philosophical question called the Ship of Theseus. And Aristotle puts the puzzle in this way. He says, imagine you have a ship and you take a piece of wood off of that ship and put it next to the other ship. And then you take another piece of wood, a plank or whatever, and you put it next to that one, and you take the ship apart, and then you rebuild an exact replica with the same material, but you've taken it apart and rebuilt it. Is it the same ship? We don't know. This has deep metaphysical roots and threads and questions. So again, to summarize, the first question we want to ask is, are these things that we're calling direwolves really direwolves? Is the DNA we're using as duplication the same thing, or is it just a copy of a copy of a copy? Next, what are our moral responsibilities with this new species, right? If we were to actually take a dire wolf and put it into the ecosystem, would it survive? Does the food that it needs still exist? Lots of people know about the paleo diet, and they talk about eating things that only existed in prehistoric times. But the food that we eat now is very genetically different than the food that we ate as Neanderthals or early Homo sapiens. Carrots are completely different. Tomatoes didn't exist in the same form. So we wouldn't be able to digest the food that early human beings ate. Would the dire wolf be able to sustain itself in our current ecosystem, and would it become a predator? Would it become prey? What happens when you put an invasive species into a new environment? So we start off with the identity question, the metaphysical question. We then move to the consequence question, and what are the unforeseen consequences? And then we ask the third question, which is, should we do it? Do we have a moral responsibility to continue or to refrain? The easiest formulation of this question is, are human beings permitted to play God? And how much do we have a right to mess with nature? This itself is a tremendously slippery question, because on the one hand, messing with DNA is a kind of playing God, but so is taking ibuprofen, right? So is putting alcohol on a cut. This is why Christian Scientists believe that medicine is immoral, and that if God wants you to heal, God will heal you. So we all play God in one form or another. How much is too much? What is good about this discussion is that it gets enough people's attention that it allows us to focus on these pivotal philosophical conundrums, so that when it happens again, we've already started thinking about it.
We've beamed in Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein for our monthly Philosophical Currents discussion. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota and host of Why? Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life. And we're talking about essentially de-extinction, bringing species back that have been declared extinct or maybe have been extinct for a very long time. What if this has crossed a line? Who's to stop whom? And as you talked about a little bit ago, playing God.
So my favorite response to the question, who's to say this is right or wrong, is me. I'm a philosopher. That's my job. That's what I'm hired to do. But in all honesty, when ethicists say, you know, can I do X, right? Is it okay to murder someone? Is it okay to resurrect species? They're not asking, do I have the free will to do it? They're not saying, is someone going to bind my hands and stop me from doing it? They're asking, should I do it? Is the act morally obligatory? Do I have to use my will and my intellect and my empathy and my sense of judgment and say, I want to do this, but I shouldn't because it's bad? So the first thing that has to happen is that the scientists have to engage in a lot of self-reflection. They have to talk with their colleagues. They have to hopefully have taken ethics classes when they were getting their PhDs. And they have to be part of a community-wide discussion of experts that takes seriously the ethical ramifications of their research. If they're not doing that, they are profoundly negligent. The second set of questions that they have to ask is, how do we balance the ethical obligations with the profit motive, right? The colossal laboratories wants to make money. They want to sell their inventions. They want investors. There's nothing wrong with wanting to make money, and there's nothing wrong with wanting to make profit, but there are certain things that we have decided are not acceptable actions. We don't sell human organs, for example. And perhaps more relevant and interesting, we're actually not allowed to sell zoo animals. Zoos can trade elephant, you know, we have an elephant, we want four otters. We'll give you the elephant for your otters. They can do that. They can do things that help cultivate the well-being of the animals, get them in the right environment, and also keep the zoo going. But there's no marketplace in that sense for animals. So we already have discussions about the moral treatment of animals as commodities, the moral treatment of animals as objects of exchange, what it means to be the advocate and the caretaker for animals. And so the scientists also have to be part and parcel of that conversation. Now, let's ask another question, such as, what is our responsibility to fix the wrongs that we've done in the past? What is our responsibility to repair damage that we may have caused, or, you know, just nature happened, right?
Redemption.
I think redemption is a really good way of thinking about this. Jurassic Park is about the question, if we make up for the destruction of the dinosaurs, are we doing something good or bad? The movie takes an easy way out, because what it basically says is we think we can control nature, but we can't. And so we're going to try to stop the destruction of innocent people, of innocent amusement parks, right? But it never answers the question definitively, should we bring the dinosaurs back from extinction?
Why are we so fascinated with this, Jack?
There is nothing more exciting about creating something from nothing. This is the wonder of art, of music, of painting, of literature, of giving birth, right? You are creating something from nothing. And when you can create something from nothing, you, in theory, can build a world or a universe that you have designed. There are lots of conversations now about whether or not it's moral to say, we're having a kid, we want to manipulate the DNA so that
which is happening apparently.
So, there's so much to say.
Oh my gosh.
So you're having a kid and you have the possibility to manipulate the DNA. You find out the kid has autism. Is it okay to manipulate the DNA so that the kid doesn't have autism? You find out the kid is deaf. Is it okay to manipulate the DNA so they're not deaf? You find out the kid has small hands and you want them to be a piano player. Is it okay to manipulate the DNA so they have big hands? We can start from questions about the most insidious diseases, the diseases that kids, they're born with their internal organs outside the skin. They live in horrendous pain for 40 minutes and then die, right? We can start with the most extreme versions, work through the spectrum going from things like autism or hearing impairment. And then we're talking about aesthetic choices. And do we want to select people for skin color or hair color or hand sizes and things like that? What's true of one side of the spectrum may not be true of the other. But these are deep questions about not just how to minimize harm and minimize pain, but also where the line is between justice and aesthetics. But there's a very big movement in the deaf community where people who are deaf want to regard being deaf as its own culture, as its own way of being in the world with norms and its own values, much like an ethnicity or something like that. And people who hold that position are often very angry at the idea that being deaf is something to be fixed. To say being deaf is less than to say someone can hear is a aesthetic value judgment and a moral value judgment that many people in the deaf community find offensive. There's this whole discussion now with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. about autism and how, from his perspective, autism is the most horrible thing in the world and there are no autistic adults left and we need to find the cause of autism and eradicate it the way that we might have eradicated polio or something like that. And first of all, empirically, he's just wrong. There are plenty of autistic adults in the world, and lots of people who have autism lead wonderful, happy, fulfilling, constructive lives. So in that sense, it's just incorrect descriptions of people in their lives. But it's on the table, and we now are having a conversation about what are the moral ramifications and the social and cultural meanings of trying to eradicate a disease. We can extend those conversations to these questions about bringing animals back from extinction and changing our overall ecosystem.
I'm going to give you the direct line to Colossal Laboratories and Biosciences, who on their website, their headline is "Making Extinction a Thing of the Past." As a philosopher, what's your message?
My message is twofold. Stop lying and slow down. That's what I would want them to do. I don't know that it's my place to have a definitive value judgment about what they're doing, in part because I'm not an expert and I don't truly understand it. But I know the truth when I see it, and I know the value of truth over falsity. So stop lying. Admit what you're actually doing so we can have an honest conversation with integrity and authenticity, and slow down so that we can all talk about what you're doing, make suggestions, and guide you to the best of all possible outcomes where we can look back at what we did and be proud and happy that we participated in.
We enjoy our monthly conversations in a segment we call Philosophical Currents with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, a professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota. Jack, this is awesome. Thanks so much for joining us on Main Street.
Oh, I love this stuff. I love ripped from the headlines conversations, but I also love the questions that force us to take a look at our core values and ask not just who we should be, but are we who we think we really are?
Still to come on Main Street, Rick Guillon explores North Dakota's German Russia food heritage with Michael Miller and Jeremy Kopp. From Nephila Soup to Lawrence Welk, that's ahead. Stay with us.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
There's the music we look forward to each and every Wednesday here on Main Street. That means it's time for Prairie Plates with our good friend Rick Guillon. Rick, welcome back to Main Street.
It's good to be back with you, Craig. How are things going?
They're going very well. We have two special guests in the Main Street studio today. Michael Miller, he spent more than five decades preserving culture, language, and food traditions of North Dakota's Germans from Russia, and as founder and director emeritus of the Germans from Russia Heritage Collection at NDSU, he sure brings a deep insight into how heritage lives on through stories and through soup, maybe. Welcome to Prairie Plates.
Yes, it's always good to be here.
And Jeremy Kopp is with us too. He's the interim director of the Germans from Russia Heritage Collection at NDSU. Jeremy, nice to visit with you.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Rick, take it over. We've got a lot to talk about of food and place, of food and history traditions and heritage and preservation.
Well, there's an upcoming event and an upcoming documentary that's going to be showing about Lawrence Welk and an upcoming event in Bismarck, May 31st at 2 p.m. about Lawrence Welk. And so I thought I would bring in the two folks that are experts in Germans from Russia heritage in North Dakota and in the Midwest. And because this is a food show, we're going to get into different Germans from Russia foods. And one of them is Nephila soup, which a lot of people think is Norwegian, but it's not. But there are a lot of other things to talk about, such as cheese buttons and kuchen, which is one of my favorite desserts.
Rick is the introduction to Michael and Jeremy, then Awana and Atua. And then they come on in and let us know what's going on.
I don't have an accordion, but yeah.
We have four in our collection, wow. So if including Lawrence Welk's. So.
Oh, wow. Well, let's get into the food a little bit. I made a list, Michael's recommendations, Jeremy's recommendations on some restaurants throughout the state of North Dakota. And I have two places that I need to try that Michael recommended. One that really looks good is Cindy's Lunchbox. Michael, what did you like about that restaurant?
Well, for the first time, I visited Cindy's Lunchbox in June of 2023 when they had their 125th anniversary at Wishing, and I was so amazed because a lot of it's takeout, it's limited space, but it's really authentic from grandma's recipes. And the day I was there, I had cheese buttons, and they were just delicious. I mean, they were almost like my mother would have made cheese buttons. And then we also had some Nephila soup, and then I think she also had some kuchen. It was the fruit kuchen. But growing up in Strasburg, North Dakota, I of course grew in a Catholic community, and you know, it can be a little different in the food recipes and the taste, but it was very similar to what I grew up with, even in Wishik, which is more of a Lutheran community.
What makes a good Nephila soup? To me, it can't be too thick. Some potatoes, not too many potatoes. I do like good dumplings. Do you guys have strong opinions on good Nephila soup?
I mean, for me, it's got to have enough Nephila. I think sometimes people skimp on the Nephila if there's not good dumplings, and they got to, for me, I like them dense. I think you like them a little less dense, if I remember you said that, but I like a dense Nephila dumpling.
Medium. I like a medium.
There you go.
Michael?
I grew up with Nephila soup where we would have, you know, potatoes, but they were small Nephila soup, not so large. I don't like them so large, which happens in some of the restaurants. And also, my mother would put in a little onions and parsley. So it was a little bit different than, and sometimes even garlic. So you have different tastes. So there can be vary. So I think you need to vary it. And for the recipe, even the people listening, that when they get the recipe for Nipple soup or other German-Russian recipes, you can vary it and taste what you like in your family.
Yeah, can I chime in, Rick, with what I think makes a good Nipple soup?
Go ahead.
And I'm not native, gentlemen, so I apologize, but I'm developing now a taste, because you have to when you live in North Dakota, right? So I think the soup should be creamy and not overly thick.
Yes.
I just don't like Correct. It when it's just overly thick. It's just not as tasty to me. That to me makes it, and the broth needs to be so flavorful.
I'd agree with that. And on my big Facebook food group, Fargo Moorhead Eats, which is about 50,000 members these days, people will comment on there that they don't want wallpaper paste.
Right. Yes. Yeah. No. If it's like gumming my teeth together, I'm not interested. Thanks.
Well, there's a variety of places around the state that I'll just kind of take a tour here quick. And Michael, Jeremy, feel free to chime in. I know we talked about a place for me to try called the Country Rose Cafe in Dickinson.
Yes, you have to try. That's the best Nephila soup I have had in the entire state. I really, really enjoyed that. I was there a couple of years ago. We were on our way out to Medora, and we stopped. And I was sitting at the counter, and I was, like, kind of full. But I was like, they have Nephila soup. I have to try this. This is, like, not just my job, but, like, kind of who I am, you know? So I ordered it, and she gave it to me, and it was the best Nephila soup. I had one bite, and I grabbed the waitress, and I said, who makes your Nephila soup? And she said, oh, my grandma, she's in the back. And I told her who I was, and I said, I'm the director of the Germans from Russia, and can I talk to her? And she said, well, I'll see if she's busy. She comes out, and I visited with her for a little bit, because truly the best Nephila soup I've had in the state. So shout out to Country Rose Cafe in Dickinson for sure.
Michael, any opinions?
Well, of course, I grew up in Strasbourg, so Nephila soup was not the primary popular dish like it is today, but we always think of the German-Russian foods in South Central North Dakota, Western North Dakota. But one of the best places I had, I remember going with Mary Ebach at Dakota Farms in Rugby. So I'm thinking that we should think of other places beyond a certain area of North Dakota. So I think there's probably some other restaurants that we don't know about that serve Fleischmann soup, Kuchen, and all those different places.
So the geographical center of North America is the Nephila soup center as well.
There you go.
Well, I'll go down the list and feel free, gentlemen, to chime in. Another place in Dickinson is Jack's Family Restaurant. I know they have good borscht, and they're right down the road from the Ukrainian Institute, so I think that's kind of neat. Freed's Family Restaurant in Mandan is really classic.
Mm-hmm. Super classic. Love Freed's. Pretty much every time we're there in Bismarck to go to the Germans from Russia convention, I make a stop at Freed's for sure.
Ohm's Cafe in Mandan is another one I've stopped at on my way to Mott and Regent, North Dakota, because I take a left on Highway 6 to go south and then 21 west. But they're kind of right on the corner, and they definitely have some items. A Little Cottage in Bismarck definitely has Nephila soup often, and I love their omelets at Little Cottage.
And their caramel rolls are unreal. That's not German-Russian. That's just good.
Yes, Little Cottage is awesome, and it's right by Big Boy. For those who don't know, in South Central North Dakota, we'll kind of get into that territory, and here's where Michael and Jeremy are real experts, but the Cullum Uptown Cafe in Cullum, the White Maid Restaurant and Bar in Napoleon, the Wild Rose Bar and Cafe in Ashley, and then I go out to southwestern North Dakota a lot, and I do see Fleischkekle and Nephila soup on the menu at the Pheasant in Mott. So, kind of a different location, a little further west, but any opinions on any of these restaurants, fellas?
Well, the one I'm most familiar with, because we would often eat at the Grill in Linton because of our filming for the television documentaries, but they really have some high quality foods. And I would recommend the Grill. You've got the standard, the historic town of Hague, and you've got the Hague Cafe. Some of these restaurants don't always have these German dishes every day.
Right.
So you have to watch for that. But then you've got there, and you've got, even at Hazleton, there's a small little cafe on Highway 83. And again, you have to, either you have to Google the restaurant or find out what the, and then call them or something to be sure that they have that dish, because it's a certain day they'll have dishes. For instance, chicken and dumplings at the grill is a certain day, or they'll have, or cheese buttons a certain day. So they have, and they're all local recipes. And when you talk about Kuchen, which I think is very important, because in the German Russia community, they say Kuchen is the bread of life because of the, it's so, such an important thing. But the model bakery at Lytton, where we filmed for the documentary, has wonderful Kuchen. You've got, of course, it's commercial. It's something like Grandma's Kuchen at Ashley, which is widely available. So also there's even a different variety of quality in Kuchen at some of these places. And it's nice when the restaurant makes their own Kuchen.
What makes a good Kuchen? And I'm going to ask both Michael and Jeremy, because they have similar opinions, but some differing opinions. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Michael.
Well, I grew up, growing up in Strasbourg, I grew up more with what you call the Catholic wedding Kuchen. And it's a thin crust Kuchen and with cinnamon on top of it. And I really like that better than the custard Kuchen is very good, but I don't like the dough so thick, which can be for many of the custard Kuchens. But so I really like, as I mentioned, the wedding Kuchen, which is becoming more popular. And it was, even the Lutherans like it now.
You know, I think custard makes the Kuchen. And whether that's a thin custard on a wedding Kuchen or a thicker custard on the traditional kind of what people imagine Kuchen and think about oftentimes, I think the custard and the flavor of the custard is the most important thing. I think sometimes people overbeat it and it becomes kind of almost eggy. And you gotta avoid that. And that's what I really love about Grandma's Kuchen out of Ashley, is that it's like they've perfected the custard. The custard is perfected on theirs. But even this year at the Germans from Russia convention in Mandan, I saw that they are going to have wedding Kuchen as an option, which they've never had before. So we get to have some wedding Kuchen at the Germans from Russia convention this year.
If I can throw a little bit in, my grandmother, who was a German from Russia, she also was Lutheran, Michael, but her Kuchen was more of like you described. It was tasty. It was really great. And we looked forward to it every time that she made it. It was the bread of our life at her home.
I should say, too, in the Gutes Essen cookbook, there is a recipe in there for Kuchen that I make. That's the one I use. It is so good. And it is a wedding Kuchen recipe, and it is perfect. And it makes like 26. So make it right before Thanksgiving, and then you have it for just give them away at holidays.
That's enough for a Lutheran church event.
Sure is.
Yeah.
We'll get into cookbooks in a little bit here, because Germans from Russia Heritage Collection is a really good resource for those cookbooks. But I did want to go over some places here in the Fargo area that has good Nefla soup or good Kuchen or good cheese buttons, because I've noticed on the menu at the new Nova Eatery downtown here, the chef Andrew Doan is from Ashley, and he has cheese buttons on the menu. And then he works for the Luna Network of restaurants, and Luna has really good Nefla soup. So I really like Nefla soup at Luna on South University, and then also at this kind of hole in the wall called Cracked Pepper.
Yes.
But Michael and Jeremy have some favorites too.
Yeah, the Diener Steinery in West Fargo, on Fridays they have Nefla soup. And I thought it was very good. And as you mentioned, Luna's on South University. I was there with dear Ann Broughton, and I thought the soup was excellent. So there are many other kinds. And Rick did a wonderful article about Nefla soup in Fargo-Moorhead. I thought it was quite impressive. I was quite surprised how many restaurants serve Nefla soup.
I tried Nefla soup at 16 places, and then I rated them. And I did gain 5 pounds, and that's no joke. But
honestly, impressive that you only gained 5 pounds.
I do walk just about every day, a couple miles. So
there you
just
go.
So folks know, I do get some exercise with all this eating I do. But there's also some newer places that have a Nefla soup, and Jeremy has a favorite.
Yeah. So I live in West Fargo, and so I'm really close to a restaurant that's relatively new called Louis. And Louis has great Nefla soup. I was actually really surprised. I've had it a couple times there. All of their food is good. Actually, I've had only good food there, but their Nefla soup, really good dumplings, really creamy, just really well made. And I need to get some more information about their chef probably and figure out how that ended up on the menu or why they decided that, because I'm happy to have a place very close to me that I can get some good Nephila soup.
One dish I wish that I could find in Fargo, but I find in Western North Dakota, especially, well, St. Henry's in Regent, the church basement, was dumplings, sauerkraut, and sliced sausage, sometimes with some potato, fried potatoes, sometimes without. That is one dish I wish I could find in Fargo. I don't know what it's called, but it's really good, and I'm sure you've...
Like Nephila and kraut, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But some sliced sausage, yeah, Stan's Supermarket, but there are other, any good sausage places out there you guys would recommend?
Well, in, again, in South Central North Dakota, it's famous for its sausages. You have wonderful sausage from the Ashley Super Value. You've got Schmidt's Locker in Napoleon. Edgley has good sausage.
Zealand, I like Zealand.
Zealand sausage is very good.
Of
course, you know, Wishick, of course, good sausage. Shares Meats in Linton has good sausage. There are many others beyond you. You know, the famous Langdon sausage.
Langdon, yeah.
But there are many other ones that I'm not aware of that are good. I think out in the Verse sausage place in Dickinson is very good. I've had some of theirs. And each has a little bit of a different taste.
Sounds like I need to do a sausage tour, Craig.
There you go.
I think you should. I think it'd be tasty.
Yeah, focus sometime on a story on sausage in North Dakota.
Let us know. We'll travel with you and taste some sausage all over the state. That sounds great.
Sounds good.
And I want to bend it back to Lawrence Welk, because that is going to be important for us here at Prairie Public. And I'm curious from both of you, with your history and understanding who Lawrence Welk was, why does he still resonate so strongly, not only with German-Russian communities here in North Dakota, but really around the country?
Well, I think, I serve as the president of the Friends of the Welk Homestead for the State Historic Site and the big events that are going to come up, which you're going to promote on Prairie Public and so forth. But Lawrence Welk leaves a legacy of a family who homesteaded in North Dakota. And it shows, I think, Lawrence is a marvelous example of hard work, Christian faith, and perseverance of doing well in your life. And I think that not only his popularity on television, but it resonates in his success story, coming off the farm and still remembering in his life that my home was always back home in North Dakota.
Yeah, and I think too, I think you think about from a German-Russian perspective, people migrating to North Dakota, living here and settling on the prairie in a very challenging thing that Lawrence Welk's family did, and he was just a baby. And to as a German-Russian, to see someone have that kind of success through their hard work, and to see someone on TV and to hear someone who sounds like you and you can like resonate with that person, I think is like, gives you an inspiration to also like commit to the things that your talents that you have. And I think that people being able to see themselves and hear themselves in Lawrence was a big part of his popularity. And even today, I mean, we see SNL even does, some Lawrence Welk skits and things still. So there's still somehow in this pop culture era a little bit somehow he's maintaining, and obviously Prairie Public still showing the Lawrence Welk show, and people come up to us all the time and tell us, we love to watch the Lawrence Welk show. We're glad that it's still on. So
when you watch his show, yes, it's very old, but you know what? Everybody is smiling, it seems to me.
Yep. And it's not, it's just it's a feel good show. It's never, you don't have to think about all the things going on in the world, right?
Exactly.
You can just zoom in on Lawrence Welk.
Everyone's happy that they're there.
And the joy.
They're enjoying themselves. They're enjoying the music for sure. They're enjoying the dancing. And it's just a pleasant show to watch, free of noise.
That's a good way to put it.
So we'll have a documentary screening again at the Heritage Center in Bismarck on May 31st at 2 p.m. And then I'd also like to recommend, if you're interested in Germans from Russia cookbooks, go to the Germans from Russia Heritage Collection at NDSU libraries, ask for Michael or Jeremy. They have a ton of church cookbooks, community cookbooks, all sorts of fun stuff to peruse through. And it's really neat. And you'll see some names like Welk or, some of these heritage names in North Dakota.
Yeah, and I would say, so we have in our cataloged cookbook collection, books that you can come browse and you can look through, you can get copies of recipes. We have over 450 of those. And then on our website, you can visit our website and click that shop online button. We also sell about 60 cookbooks that you can just buy online. We will ship it to your house anywhere in the United States, well, anywhere in the world, really. And we're happy to get those to you as quick as possible. But you can search that we have indexes and you can see which recipes are in each cookbook and names even that are in each cookbook. So if you're looking for a specific person from a specific town, we can help make sure you get that cookbook as well.
Our guests today have been Michael Miller. He spent more than 5 decades preserving culture, language, and food traditions of North Dakota's Germans from Russia, and was the founder and is currently the director emeritus of the Germans from Russia Heritage Collection at NDSU. And also with us today, Jeremy Kopp. He's the interim director of the Germans from Russia Heritage Collection at NDSU. Rick, it's been a pleasure to have our guests with us today. Thank you all for joining us today on Prairie Plates.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Minot Symphony Orchestra presents a special movie night screening of Walt Disney's The Lion King with Hans Zimmer's unforgettable musical score performed live to the film. The concert will be held on Saturday, May 3rd at 7 p.m. in Ann Nicole Nelson Hall at Minot State University. More information and ticket availability may be found online at minotsymphony.com or by calling the box office at 701-858-4228.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 30th. The end of April sees North Dakota firmly into the spring season. Winter's grip is largely absent, and the excitement of warmer weather and planting gardens brings optimism and happiness. Still, the weather sometimes has a few surprises for the region. Cold temperatures targeted central and western North Dakota, threatening and damaging emerging plants and crops with frost. The Bismarck Tribune reported damage to garden plants, though fruit escaped unharmed, as a heavy frost hit the region. Bismarck recorded a low of 24 degrees, with the cold spot being Napoleon at 17 degrees, where fruit-bearing plants were damaged. Bismarck's low was well above the record low for that date, which was 16 degrees in 1903. Though the record low high temperature of 31 degrees set in 1909 would likely give residents pause as well. Other communities in the region also reported cold temperatures. Dickinson and Dunn Center saw damage to fruit and oats, with lows reaching 20 degrees in both areas. The cold pattern stretched across North Dakota. Minot recorded a low of 21, Williston 20, Devil's Lake 26, Jamestown 22, and Grand Forks and Fargo recorded 28 and 30 degrees, respectively. Weather observer O.W. Roberts reported that the cold would last through the remainder of the week. In addition to the cold weather, some of Bismarck's drivers made the front page for violating motor vehicle laws. 9 drivers faced fines for offenses ranging from speeding, accounting for 6 of the drivers, to driving without lights, and 2 who drove on the left side of the road. All appeared before Judge W.C. Cashman's police court and either pled guilty or were found guilty and fined $10 and court costs. 8 other drivers were arrested and ordered to appear that evening. Bismarck's police chief, Chris Martinson, reminded drivers that they faced arrest starting May 1st if they were still using 1924 license plates. He stressed that drivers had 4 months to get new plates and that there was no excuse for continuing to operate vehicles with expired tags. Late-season cold snaps and driving infractions are nothing out of the ordinary in our community. Looking back at past accounts reminds us that some things never change, despite the passage of time. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Daniel Sauerwine. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The Trump administration has been slashing budgets for public health, environmental protection, and education. Big donors and billionaires have stepped up to fill that gap, but most have a different approach.
You've seen lots of foundations either say explicitly or sort of implicitly message that they don't have enough money to do this sort of thing.
Can philanthropy replace public funding? That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
that's it for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. And just a quick programming note, at 7 p.m. Central this evening, Prairie Public will mark 100 days of the Trump administration examining changes at home and abroad with a special report hosted by NPR's Michelle Martin. We hope you can tune in for that. And we'll be back again tomorrow with another edition of Main Street.